Welcome to Accounting Influencers, the podcast for accounting leaders and influencers who want to know exactly what makes the good firms great and the great accountants world class. Let's get today's show started with your host and founder of the BD Academy, Rob Brown.
Welcome to the show, and I'm thrilled to have with me today the legend that is Ron Baker. Ron, hello to you.
Hello, Rob. Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
It's an honor to have you on the show, Ron. And for the benefit of people that may not have come across you, and I can't believe there are not many, would you just tell us a bit about you and your passion in life and what you do?
Wow. I'm a recovering CPA who started my life in a Big Eight accounting firm. I knew I wanted to be a CPA in high school. And when I got out of the Big Eight after 2.5 years, started my own firm. And when you run your own firm, as you know, Rob, you're wearing every hat, right? You're the marketer, you're the HR director, you're the janitor.
That's entrepreneurs generally, isn't it? Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just ran into this wall of pricing. I just got tired of customers running in saying, hey, why didn't you tell me it was going to cost so much? My only response was, well, I spent the time. Well, I learned really fast customers don't care about the time we spend. What they care about are the outcomes. So in 1989, we started experimenting with fixed pricing and made every mistake in the book, but stuck with it. And that's been my passion ever since.
Now, are accountants the only profession industry that has a problem with pricing, or do we encounter this in other industries?
Oh, yeah. You encounter it in any profession or business whose essential business model is we sell time.
Right.
So anybody who charges by the hour. So Verisage works with law firms, with IT consulting firms, with consulting firms, the actuarial firms, architectural firms, engineering firms, accounting firms, advertising agencies. All of those are mired in the billable hour.
Mm. How damaging is the billable hour?
Incredibly damaging, because there's many problems with it. But the big one is it doesn't account for value from the customer's perspective. It's completely silent with respect to value. It only looks at the inputs. It doesn't look at the outcomes. And since we're all knowledge workers in the accounting profession, our work should be based and valued and priced based on the outcome it achieves, not the inputs.
Well, I wondered how long it would be before the word value came up. And for the purposes of clarification, if we looked at value in the Ron Baker Dictionary of Life and Business, what would be there?
Well, value has got a very old antecedent. I mean, actually, it's economists who own this topic intellectually, because they've been talking about it and writing about it for centuries. I mean, going back to the days when they were called moral philosophers. Value is the maximum amount a consumer is willing to pay for an item. But it's also subjective. It's in the eyes of the beholder, and it's also very contextual, which is why you're starting to see so many firms put together options for their customers, like three options.
But value is, you touched on it, it's such a subjective word, isn't it? And doesn't that create a problem for accountants that are very technical and defined and structured, and everything has to be just so?
Yes. Yeah. This took me a long time to get my head around, Rob, but value is not a number. It's a feeling. And we accountants, we have troubles with things that, you know, are not quantifiable, that you can't carry out to two decimal places. I think our profession sometimes rather be precisely wrong rather than approximately right. But when it comes to value and pricing, you have to be comfortable with ambiguity, and you have to be comfortable knowing that there's not a precise numerical answer to it. It's based on, it's so much more psychology than anything else.
Well, I'm going to ask you about value pricing 1.0 and now value pricing 2.0, but just for a bit of wider context, what kind of shape do you feel the accounting profession is in right now? You call them CPAs, we call them accountants.
I'm rather bullish on the profession. I have my problems with it. I think it's got a relevancy problem, especially when you turn to the big end of the market, like the big four, top 100 firms, whatever.
How do you mean relevancy, Ron?
I just think that accounting is what philosophers call a deteriorating paradigm, especially in the U.S. GAAP is becoming more and more complex. And as it becomes more and more complex, it explains less and less. And I think that's a big problem. I mean, if we really think that stock market investors or other third parties are using our financial statements to make decisions, we're insane. To run a business based on financial statements is equivalent of timing your cookies with your smoke alarm. It's a lagging indicator at best, and it's becoming more and more irrelevant to actual economic endeavors. There's a great book on this, by the way, from an accounting professor, Baruch Lev, called The End of Accounting, and I would encourage your listeners to take a look at it.
Great. We'll check that out. So the accounting profession, despite that, you feel is in a pretty good state?
That's a complicated, I don't have a really good precise answer to that. I have a lot of problems with the accounting profession. It's stuck in this literally 100-year-old business model of we sell time. It makes its smart, incredibly intelligent knowledge workers fill out a timesheet and account for every 6 minutes of their day like they were in prison. And that disturbs me to no end. I just don't think that's a long-term way to attract really talented people into a profession. Once they get there, they have to account for every 6 minutes of their day. And they're measured based on their inputs rather than their ability to create outputs. Mm. I think that's a big problem. And I think that goes back to the business model.
Give us value pricing 1.0. as you were looking at a few years ago, and then we'll move on to 2.0.
Yeah, value pricing 1.0 was you price the customer, not the services. And so rather than thinking about pricing accounting work, you're pricing the customer based upon the customer's special circumstances and what their desired outcomes were. So every package, whether you're offering options or just one fixed price, is custom tailored and the customer is being priced.
Why have we grown out of value pricing in 1.0 now? What's moved this on?
Well, I think value pricing 2.0, as I like to call it, is, and I've just been exchanging emails with Mark Wickersham about this, and it's something that I'm still grappling with, so I don't have all the answers to this. But if you just look out there in the world, there's a massive macro trend going on, and it's the subscription business model.
Yeah.
All of us probably have 10, 12, 20 things we subscribe to, whether it's Netflix, Amazon Prime, whatever. And we're used to subscriptions. And I think there's ways to modify that model and bring it into a professional firm.
Yeah, well, changing business models changes your pricing strategy. It changes your metrics. It's a whole new dashboard, isn't it?
It is. And that's a really important point, Rob. I don't want to just bounce off that. That is so true. I'm kind of a student of business models. And I can tell you, looking throughout commercial history, anytime we see a business model change, two things change. Pricing strategies change, but also the metrics. And this is, by the way, why the timesheet must go. Because you can't change your business model if you're still measuring time. I don't care what consultants to the profession say, they're ignorant of the history. The timesheet has to go if you change your business model. Otherwise, if you keep the old metrics, you're going to be stuck with the old model.
Yeah, I'm sure you've read John Warrilow's Automatic Customer like a lot of us, Ron. And even before you read that, though, you must have sensed the sea change and the way other industries are going and becoming more subscription-based.
Yeah, I have. I've been long completely immersed into concierge medicine in the States. I know in Europe it might not be a big deal because you guys have different healthcare over there. But here, there's a lot of doctors going off the grid, not accepting, you know, government patients anymore, maybe even not in accepting private insurance patients.
Just define concierge medicine for us. Thank you.
Basically, what these doctors will say to, and they usually handle very wealthy individuals, CEOs, they're time pressured, and they'll say, Rob, for you and your family of four, it's $40,000 a year, and we will take care of anything medical that we're capable of doing under our roof. And by the way, those capabilities are constantly expanding, MRI machines, pharmacology, dispension, all of that type of stuff. We'll just handle it. So it's not just a subscription to a group of services. It's certainly not price for services. It is insurance. It's peace of mind. So here's the thing with value pricing 2.0, where 1.0 said you price the customer, not the service. Value pricing 2.0 in the subscription model is you price the portfolio, not the customer.
So we're not just looking at a suite of products and services or even that peace of mind. You're pricing the whole transformation as well, aren't you?
That's right. You're pricing the relationship.
Yeah.
Let me give you a tangible example of this. Mm. Today in Atlanta, Georgia, you can subscribe to a Porsche. So it's $3,000 a month. And here's the thing. Porsche pays everything. Everything. Your insurance, your registration. The only thing they don't pay is gas. They take care of all the maintenance, and you can trade in different models unlimited any time. So if you say, well, I've got guests coming, I need an SUV for the week or whatever, they'll drive you out an SUV. Because here's the thing with this, Rob, and this is why it's so brilliant. You're not subscribing to a Porsche. You're subscribing to Porsche.
Mm-hmm.
That's huge. You know, think about how much money automobile companies spend to get you to repurchase.
Yeah.
now they're locking in these customers for life. You should go read the customer reviews. It's called the Porsche Passport Program.
Yeah.
And it's very limited. And now Hertz, Enterprise, Audi, Volvo, I can't even keep up with them, Hyundai, Cadillac, they all have models like this. They all differ in their own ways. But the analysts say that 1 out of 4 cars in the USA will be subscribed to by 2023. And I believe it.
It just shows you, doesn't it, how you can turn almost any industry into a subscription model.
Yeah, you just have to tease out what the underlying value proposition is. We run a workshop on this and we ask people, why would you subscribe to a pair of shoes? Why would you subscribe to your roof? Well, if your roof was solar, why wouldn't you want to subscribe to it? You know, why do we have to own everything? I mean, ownership comes with a lot of hassles, maintenance, trade-in, but you know, just all repair. Mm. Now there's just all these models just busting loose, letting you subscribe. And there's just a million of them. As you mentioned, Don Warlow's book is excellent, but there's also another one called Subscribed by Tian Zhou, who runs Zora, which is a software company that is specifically designed for subscription-based businesses.
Well, Amazon have led the way, haven't they? A lot of people now have that Amazon Prime account. They're paying monthly for access to this free delivery, etc. You can get shoes, you can get razors, can't you, that are on subscription. So where are accountants lagging behind in the subscription model, and what do they need to do to take this on?
I think they just need to start testing it. They just need to start doing it. Stop trying to overanalyze it. Just give them a basic package. Say, well, we'll do your books, we'll do your tax return, we'll take care of all your compliance issues on a subscription basis. Basically, it's a fixed price and it might go up every year for cost of living or whatever. You can exclude other types of services, like if they're going to sell their business or other types of services can be excluded from those packages. But my idea on this, Rob, and this is why it's so radical, is why not be like a concierge doctor and say, hey, we'll take care of anything we're capable of doing. And what they're really buying at that point is peace of mind. Right. And think about it. We all buy insurance. It's a $3.3 trillion worldwide industry. And the thing about it is, from a psychological perspective, we're thrilled to pay insurance and we're thrilled when we don't use it. I want a model like that.
Mm. How would that work for CPAs, though? What are you mitigating against?
Anything that comes up, they're handled. They're buying peace of mind. They're in good hands. If they get audited by the Inland Revenue, okay, you'll handle it. Yeah. Anything that comes up, you're there for them, whatever it is.
This is trusted advisor domain, isn't it?
Absolutely. Even though I don't like that term very much, but that's what it turns you into. It values the relationship. And, you know, you brought up Amazon Prime. Amazon Prime members spend 7 times more with Amazon than non-Prime members.
Wow.
That's the real point. Yeah. It was never about free shipping. It was about, hey, we want you to buy everything here. And Prime members tend to do that.
Yeah. So if you were to cast your mind ahead 2, 3, 5 years, we see how Netflix has gone now, Spotify. These are all subscription models that, as you rightly say, are part and parcel of people's everyday lives now. What might it look like if the accounting profession really ran with this?
Oh, I think there'd be an effervescence of different models out there.
That's a great word.
Yeah, that customers could choose from. I mean, we see Intuit going into QuickBooks Live. They're basically offering bookkeeping on a subscription-based model. There's 3 plans you can choose from, and there would just be a lot of different choice for the customer. But the important thing is you're giving them predictability, and they know exactly what they're buying. And I actually think it would increase customer loyalty. Why couldn't there be like an American Express Black Card for a certain group of customers that where you say, hey, anything that comes up, you're taken care of. Doesn't matter what it is. Doesn't matter how long it's going to take. You're our customer and we're going to treat you like gold. That's a high price. I'm not saying, you know, the American Express Black Card is $5,000 a year, but you get a 24/7, 365 concierge. Why don't accounting firms do that? Why don't dentists do it? You're starting to see it more and more. It's self-insurance. And again, I'd much rather be an insurance, a fire insurance salesman than a fireman. It's more profitable.
Yeah, I totally see that. Are you seeing any difference in the way accounting firms set up their business models as we start to weave this change into the practices?
The kids coming out now and starting up firms, and there's so many of them, we've interviewed some of them on our show, they have no tolerance for the billable hour and timesheet. So they just start from scratch and they, you know, whether they offer subscription pricing or 3 options or fixed pricing, whatever they call it, we are seeing a change in the business model is happening at the low end. And it has been going on for the last 20 years or so. But I can tell you this, in the top 100, in the United States at least, There are many in the top 100 now, probably over 10, that are seriously going down the value pricing road. When I say move down this road, I mean making serious commitments to it. And it cracks me up to hear some of these firms talk about how this can't be done. And I just say, look at Bain and look at McKinsey. They did it.
Yeah.
Bain and McKinsey do not use the billable hour and they don't do timesheets.
But isn't part of the problem the culture in firms? They're run by these baby boomers, these traditionalists, Ron, that can't get their head around value pricing. And there's not enough of these up-and-coming millennials that have no fear for stuff like this. There's not enough of those to bring about change.
There is something to that. I mean, I know the Max Planck line, you know, science progresses funeral by funeral, and maybe some of those boomers are going to have to die off to make any progress. But that said, I don't think the adoption of value pricing is necessarily an age thing.
Okay.
Some of our biggest believers have been older people in their 50s, even 60s and 70s that have looked at this and said, hey, this is a better way. Why didn't I learn this, you know, 40 years ago? So I don't think it's an age thing, but there's no doubt that there's a lot of inertia, and changing the business model of a profession is no easy thing. And by the way, that business model of We Sell Time started in the legal profession in the United States. A guy named Reginald Heber Smith was the first gentleman to introduce both the timesheet and the billable hour simultaneously into his law firm in the year 1919. We are at a 100-year anniversary of this business model. And when I ask CPAs or accountants, has the world changed in the last 100 years?
No.
Why are you stuck in a 100-year business model?
Wow. So we can blame the lawyers for this mess. Then.
Absolutely. Shakespeare, shoot all the lawyers.
Great.
Yeah, definitely. It's the lawyer's fault.
What do you think makes a good accounting firm great?
Oh, wow. I think the recognition that it's all about intellectual capital. It's not about time. It's not about leveraging hours. It's about leveraging ideas. And ideas and knowledge are non-rival assets, according to economists, meaning that if I have a tie and I give you my tie off my shirt, now you have it and I don't. That's a rival asset. But if I give you an idea or some knowledge, now you have it, but I still have it. I didn't lose it. And you can take it and you can expand on it. And that's how the world grows, right? The knowledge is wealth. Where does economic growth come from? It comes from learning. And those firms that are learning firms and are constantly experimenting and constantly offering new things to their customers and looking for better ways to create a better customer experience are the dynamic firms. Those are the great ones. And those are the ones people want to work for, by the way.
Yeah.
I don't want to work for a firm where I'm just viewed as a machine. I have to run at 90% capacity and I have to account for every 6 minutes of my day. I want to be able to make a contribution and be judged on my outputs, not my inputs.
Yeah, it's a really good point. And when you talk about knowledge being intellectual property and competitive advantage, certainly knowledge of your customers, your client, that's an advantage that can't be duplicated or replicated.
That's right. And that's even more true in the subscription model, because that is truly one-on-one marketing. If you think about what Amazon knows about us, it's amazing.
Yeah. I dread to think.
Yeah, some people have privacy issues with it, but I mean, from a marketing standpoint, that is the ultimate one-on-one, and firms can do that just as easily.
So I asked you what makes a good accounting firm great. What do you feel makes a good CPA, a good accountant great?
I think somebody who's constantly investing in their human capital, somebody who's curious, somebody who's constantly learning, maybe trying new things, maybe even devising new specialties every 3 or 5 years. I have a colleague, Dan Morris, who believes, I think he's got attention deficit disorder. But that said, he believes that, you know, every 3 years or so, you should find a new specialty. It takes 1 year to get excited about it, 1 year to master it, third year to kind of cash in on it, and then jump to something else. Since I've known him, he's probably specialized in about 10 different areas, all highly complex, by the way. I mean, like international tax and, you know, all these different things. But I think that's kind of interesting. I love specialization. I do think firms should specialize, but that doesn't mean you just have to limit yourself to one thing. You can bounce around within even those specialties, I think.
Yeah. How you describe an accountant, though, they're not inherently curious. They're very technical in nature. I'm generalizing, of course, but when you're talking about what makes good accountants great, are we talking about a new breed of accountants?
certainly at the leadership level. Quite frankly, I don't want to be led by anyone who doesn't read 50 books a year. Where the heck are they getting their new ideas? Where are they learning anything? You know, are they reading Twitter? Are they reading social media? You know, that's cotton candy. People, I think, want to look up to their leaders and be led by people with a vision. And I think the accounting profession lacks vision. I don't think it inspires anybody to say, we need to grow realization by 5%. That's not an inspiring goal. And that's what most firm leaders talk about. And that, to me, is really petty.
It's my contention that the modern day accountant has five core skills. The first is technical, which is a given. That's the foundation. Then it's technological. In this day and age, you've got to know your way around the tech. Then you've got people skills. You've got to be able to build these relationships, have these courageous conversations that you're referring to. Fourth is commercial acumen. You've got to have that insight, that perspective, that wider reading, that intellectual capital, if you like, from other industries to feed into your clients, your new ideas. And then the fifth one is selling skills. Doesn't matter how good you are or how much you know, everything needs selling. You've got to sell yourself, your ideas, your IP, your arguments, your excuses. Would you go along with those?
Yeah, I think that's a fantastic list. And the people skills is obviously important, at least for the leadership. And I'm not saying everybody has to be a leader. Not everybody wants to be a partner these days, and that's fine. But for the leaders of these firms, when I listen to some of them talk and I think, what is your vision? Where do you see this firm in 5-10 years? And I just hear these petty things about, oh, well, we need to grow realization by 3%. I'm thinking, you know, it'd be like Martin Luther King standing on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial saying, you know, I have quarterly objectives. No, he didn't say that. He said, I have a dream.
What do you love most about what you do, Ron? You come across as a very passionate guy.
Changing the way people see the world, but not only changing how they think about it, but changing how they practice in it. If they go back and do something, that's really exciting. And that's the most gratifying thing in the world. Because when I started doing this in my practice with my partner, and when we saw the dramatic results, it changes everything. It's a saner way to run a firm. I just wanted to share it with my colleagues first. And now I've been sharing it with the world, basically all professionals. And so our goal is to move all professionals, change this, you know, 100-year-old archaic business model.
Yeah, one thing I'm really taken by with you is that you seem to be an inveterate learner. You're constantly, although you've been doing this a long time, always looking for new ideas and ways of processing those and looking for the patterns. Do you have a personal philosophy for success?
I guess my personal philosophy on success is just constantly learn. I worry that a lot of people in our profession don't read. I mention books to them and say, have you read like The End of Accounting, which I think is like a nuclear bomb dropped on our profession. And nobody knows about this book. Yeah. I'm appalled by that. Everybody should be debating that book, good, bad, or indifferent. But it should be in the profession's conversation. And it's not.
Is there anything you've changed your mind on in the last few years?
Yes. In fact, we did a whole show on changing minds. I'll give you one example I changed my mind over. And okay, this is totally politically incorrect. And I'm probably going to get blasted for it, but I don't care. When I was in high school and college, I used to be fervently pro-choice on abortion. Now, that's a tough issue to talk about. But over the years, I studied, I read more. I read from different people, the Pope. I read encyclicals. I read all these. And now I'm avidly pro-life.
Wow.
And I grappled with that topic for a decade and debated it with friends and debated it with people who were adopted. That was a big mind shift change. So yeah, and there's a whole list. It's actually on the show notes to that show called Changing Your Mind.
Yeah, we'll look it up. Is there anything you believe deeply that other people think is crazy?
Oh, yeah. Getting rid of timesheets would be one of them. I think the subscription economy is something that, you know, I've been talking about for the last couple of years that people think I'm nuts.
You come across as a very mild speaking guy. What makes your blood boil? Do you ever get angry?
I used to debate a lot more pre-social media time, but I've actually really mellowed out over the years. And I guess it's just partly having a platform and a voice where I can write or I can do my radio show and people will listen to what I say. So I don't feel the need to defend. And I also try and always learn from other people. I learn more from people I disagree with.
Yeah.
I mean, let's face it, we don't learn much from people that we agree with. And as much as I think the choir needs to be preached to, right? No priest says, hey, choir, you can leave now. No, the choir needs preaching too as well. But I really like the voices of dissent, people who challenge my ideas. I have to admit, I love to bury them too.
Yeah.
You know, but sometimes they put a chink in the armor and you end up changing your mind.
Yeah. Ron, this has been fascinating today and hopefully the first of a few that we'll do with you just to go deeper into some of these topics. If people want to find out more about the great stuff that you do, what's the best way for them to reach you?
I'm all over LinkedIn. I'm one of their influencers and I have lots of blog posts up there, but you can also find me at Twitter at Ronald Baker. You can also find me on my radio show's site, which is thesoulofenterprise.com. We are a live radio show. We run every Friday. You can also subscribe on iTunes, wherever you get your podcasts. We've done 250 shows. We're in our sixth year. We've interviewed tons of economists, done value pricing, you name it. We've covered it. Or you can email me. I'm always happy to talk to our colleagues, Ron at verisage.com, which is V as in Victor, E-R-A-S-A-G-E.com.
That's great. I wanted to ask you very briefly, just in closing, about VeriSage. Tell us a little bit about that organization, what it does.
I didn't want to start a consulting firm. What I wanted to do was basically just work with really, really smart people. So the best model for that, in my mind at the time, was the think tank model. So I created VeriSage as a think tank to bring together really, really smart people, like my colleague Ed Kless, who I do the radio show with. I've got 20-some-odd fellows spread out around the world who are preaching and teaching this method or living it. And we all get together and we're kind of a disembodied group, but we're held together by a set of ideals and ideas. And just to kind of concretize that for you, what that means is I could literally fly almost anywhere in the world, hook up with a fellow, do a full day workshop with them, and it would come off like it was completely choreographed because we know each other so well in terms of what we believe. We can work really, really well together. And that's really exciting.
Yeah. Ron, this has been world-class today. Would you leave us with a few words of encouragement for the accountants, the CPAs listening that want to embrace some of the ideas on value pricing 2.0, maybe dip their toes into the world of value? How might they even get started?
Yeah, just check out the book. Like you mentioned, The Automatic Customer, check out the work by Tianzo, Subscribed. We've done 3 shows, I believe, on the subscription model, The Soul of Enterprise. And just experiment with it. Stop trying to overanalyze it. Stop trying to figure out every possible contingency. Just jump in. Try it with one customer. Try it with a new customer. Just see how it goes. See how it changes the dynamics of the relationship. There's so much of it that is really hard to communicate, Rob, because it changes the relationship. And that's something that's very hard to convey to people until they live through it. But once you put somebody on a fixed price, whether it's subscription or just a fixed price for a year, it changes the dynamic of the relationship. And that's what's so exciting about it.
Ron Baker, that's been so enjoyable and an absolute honor. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Rob. Appreciate it.
You've been listening to Accounting Influencers, the podcast for accounting leaders and influencers who want to know exactly what makes the good firms great and the great accountants world class. For show notes on today's and other episodes, plus some great blogs and resources to help accountants lead, sell, and perform at the highest levels, go to bdacademy.pro. Until next time, have a fantastic day.